Last week, if you were here, we talked about the Battle of Armageddon, Revelation 16, 16. As we sorted through that, we said that that word seems to describe sorrow, the mountain or the hill of sorrow, especially the mountain of sorrow. And the suggested interpretation was, especially when we look at where we are as far as the trumpets, finished up the sixth and ready for the seventh, Armageddon is simply another way of describing what will take place for the unsaved at the end of time. In other words, it's a figurative way of describing hell. The sorrow that unsaved people will experience, and we'll kind of continue to build on that thought as we come to the end of Revelation 16. We want to start with the 19th verse in Revelation 16. Here John says, "And the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell." And Babylon, that's one of the reasons why I gave you that sheet, and we're going to hear more about Babylon, read more about Babylon as we get into Revelation 17 soon today. The cities of the nations fell, and Babylon, the great city, was remembered in the sight of God, to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. Now, in this book, we find multiple references to the word city. And when we see this word being used, we have to remember that it's used in a couple of different ways. Sometimes the word city is used in a positive way. For example, back in Revelation chapter 3, Revelation 3 verse 12, when John talks to the church located at Philadelphia, he talked about a city. Speaking of this figure, this symbol, not in literal terms, but in symbolic terms, and it is there a reference to the saved. You know, God has a city in this life as far as his people, and then in the ultimate sense, there will be heaven. Then back in Revelation 11, verse 12, John talked about a holy city. Well, the word holy is another way of saying that in that particular passage, it was a description for righteous people, for good people. So Revelation 3, Revelation 11, leaves us with no doubt the city can sometimes have a positive meaning. But as we look here at the end of Revelation chapter 16, you've got God's cup, the wine of his wrath associated with the city. So would you think then in this particular passage, are we dealing with people represented by a city as good folks or bad folks? Bad. So you always have to use the context to determine whether a word has the same meaning as it does elsewhere in the Bible and kind of exactly what we're dealing with. We've said before, John is a writer who likes to contrast righteousness with unrighteousness. And we've looked at some of the contrasts before. You've got truth and error. You've got right and wrong. You've got light and darkness. And in the book of Revelation, one of the contrasts that we find is between two cities. There is the city that represents the righteous. There is the city that represents the unrighteous. And in this book, and we've not quite gotten this far yet, but John's going to talk about a radiant woman. And then he's also going to talk about a prostitute. He's going to talk about a harlot. And he uses, as I said, these images as well, just like the image of a city, to describe what we might refer to as unremitting warfare between the side of right and the side of wrong. And as you look at human history, you have this spiritual battle, which sometimes also seeps over into the secular realm, but this spiritual battle is something that's been going on for a long, long time. Now, Babylon, as we think about this symbol, there are a couple of things involved with it. I think that there's some general evil involved with it, but also, as you go back, and we studied about this in Revelation 14, verse 8, there also seems to be a strong connection to false religion. Well, here John's talking about this great city that is a lot of evil associated with this, a lot of things contrary to God's will, God's way, true for Rome, also true for really the entire Christian era. And John says, what happened to the city? It divided, and you also have the fall occurring. The cities of the nations, the other things associated with this power also crumbled. And then they were forced to drink what? All right, the cup of God's divine wrath. When you think about this, and we've talked about this a little bit before, but remember back in Matthew 15? It was there Jesus said, "This people honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. But in vain do they worship me, teaching as their doctrines of men." And then as you skip verse 10, you get down to this point in Matthew 15, verse 11. He said, remember that next word, that my Father has not planted. Every plant which my heavenly Father has not planted is going to be rooted up. Well, do you think he was talking about squashing cucumbers? What kind of plant was he referring to? Well, when you look at Matthew 15, verses 8 and 9, these people honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me, but in vain do they worship me. So when we think about, we're talking about religious groups. Well, when John comes over to the book of Revelation, he's teaching that same point. Jesus said, how many religious groups that are not authorized by God are going to be ripped up? Every single one. Well, that's John's point here. You have Babylon out there, and there's a lot of stuff going on with Babylon, including false religion. And John is saying that it's going to be destroyed. Well, that's not a new message. We've seen that before back in places like Matthew chapter 15. But it is a great, great power, as John describes here. And as we mentioned before, going back a little bit earlier in the book of Revelation, remember how many beasts in Revelation chapter 13? One comes from the land, one comes from the sea. How many would that be?
Two.
That's two. That's the math that I've got. All right. One of those beasts, the first one represents evil civil government. The second one represents false religion. And these, as we've seen throughout the book of Revelation, and as we're going to continue to see, John uses Satan and these two symbols. When we get a little further into the book, he's going to talk about how they're going to be cast into the lake of fire and so forth. But Satan has these two great helpers. Well, here John finally says, and we're going to see this again, because remember, John tells you something, he pauses for a bit, comes around and talks about it again from a different perspective, talks about it again from a different angle, and he just keeps coming back to these same things with different images. Here he says Babylon is going to be divided into three parts. When you see the word divide, sometimes that's a good thing. You know, if somebody's going to divide up an inheritance, most people are pleased by that. But would you say here the word divide has a positive connotation or a negative connotation? It's negative. I mean, it's going to fall. So when he talks about dividing, it's a way of saying it's going to be Matthew 15, 11, or 13, I think it's 13 instead of 11. If we use the word there, it's going to be rooted up. It's going to be removed. And this is precisely what, you know, John's already said. As you look back across the page, Revelation 14:8. And another, a second angel followed, saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. Well, he's already covered this stuff, but he's coming back from a slightly different perspective. Babylon's fallen, that hath made all the nations to drink of the wine of the cup of her fornication. What she had done now is being done to her in Revelation chapter 16, the end of the chapter. You know, when we look at this life, there are some sources of evil that we may think are just too big to overcome. But John, as he talks about sin, wickedness, and like I say, even false religion, the days that these powers have are really numbered. And God, at the right time, is going to completely overthrow them. But they cannot stand against God. Anything that you quickly want to say before we pick up with verses 20 and 21? Kind of finish out the chapter. Betty? Okay, we've been talking about Matthew 24 on Wednesday nights. If I am dating the book of Revelation correctly, we're probably looking at a time of about 90, which, if that's correct, then Jerusalem would have fallen about 20 years prior to this time. So we would have some of the same principles, I think, as far as, you know, bad religion. There was some wickedness, but I'd be cautious beyond moving much beyond that basic comparison with what we have here in Revelation 16/17 and Matthew 24. So, but there are some principles that would be the same, and really throughout the whole era, as far as people, you've got bad civil government and you've got corrupt religion. Bessie, did you have a thought in there too?
No.
Okay. Or Harvey? Looked like one of you guys had maybe an additional thought. Okay, 20 and 21. Let's finish out the chapter now, Revelation 16. And every island fled, and the mountains were not found. And great hail, every stone about the weight of a talent, cometh down out of heaven upon men. And men blaspheme God because of the plague of the hail, for the plague thereof is exceeding great. Now, which plague is this? Anybody know? How many total plagues are there?
Seven.
Anybody know which one this is? All right, and that's right. How do you get that information? All right, let's get it from the Bible. It's verse 17. So he's talking about the seventh plague. Well, what have we said about the seventh plague? Same thing we've said about the seventh trumpet and the seventh seal. Where does that take us time-wise? It takes us, you know, the Lord has come, the earth has been burned up, and we're now basically at the judgment scene. This is the end of time. Well, that helps us a little bit, because some people, when they look at passages like this, they say, oh, hey, look, we've got some great things happening on the earth. There in verse 20, every island fled away. The mountains were not found. Well, can you imagine what that would look like literally? You know, you got some islands out there in the Caribbean, they just disappear. And you got the mountains out there, the Rocky Mountains, and bang. You know, where are they? Well, he's not talking about literal things. Now, if you remember back, and we might want to go back and take a look at this, Revelation 8. I know that was a while back, and it may take a couple minutes for us to kind of mentally get back in the groove here a bit, but let's take a look at it. He says, and the first sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and there were cast upon the earth, and the what? The third part of the earth. Do you remember our discussion about the third part? Now, some people try to interpret this literally and say, well, okay, let's divide the planet into thirds and bang. You know, this is what happens to a third of the planet. No. What are we dealing with when we talk about the third part? The spiritual part of man. The fourth part refers to the physical part of man. Very good. So he's talking about the spiritual part of man. And he goes on to say, the third part of the trees was burned up. And all the green grass was burned up. Do you remember what we said about the green grass and the trees? Green grass is a symbol, not literally. But we're dealing with the spiritual part of man. What's going to be sturdier? Grass? Big tree. The tree is. It's an image for people. We're talking about the righteous people. Remember that green grass, that tender green grass, is compared to a Christian who is young, Christian who doesn't have the spiritual roots, the spiritual depths, where he or she is like that tree. Well, John's using that same kind of imagery over here in Revelation chapter 16 when he talks about the mountains and the islands. Let's get a couple examples here. Let's go back, and as we've said many times, John often pulls from the Old Testament. Let's have somebody go back. You have a minute to get there. Jeremiah 51. Look at Jeremiah chapter 51, verses 24 and 25. Who'd like to pick up that reference for us? All right, Steve. And then let's take a look at the islands. Isaiah 59, verse 18 should be okay for that. Isaiah 59, verse 18. Josh, we'll have you look at that. Okay, Jeremiah 51. Let's look at verses 24 and 25. Okay, now there it is. He says, you're a destroying mountain. Well, mountains, do they literally destroy? No. But as you look at this, he's talking about which nation? Babylon. And then as he continues the thought, he refers to him as a mountain, a destroying mountain. That is, the nation of Babylon was hurtful to the people of God at various times. So if you go back and you look at how the Bible in the Old Testament uses words like mountain, oftentimes you find that in this particular case, you have that referring to a great power, a great national power. You know, we're impressed by mountains as far as their size, their height, their strength and so forth, if you will. So it is an Old Testament symbol to essentially say, when we get to the end of time, remember, we're dealing with the end of time. We've got the seventh plague here. People will still be in opposition to God. But will they be able to band together as a nation and oppose God? No. I mean, there's not going to be any force, there's not going to be any power that is on the opposite side of God that's going to be able to come together. The strongest nations on the earth, the strongest nations throughout time, whether that's America, or you go back and you look at Rome, or you go back and you look at Germany, at the zenith of its power, they will not be able to band together. There will be nothing that they can do. And you have a similar thing that's true for the islands. He's not literally talking about the island out there in the Caribbean or the island out there in the Great Lakes or something. Let's have that other reference read, Josh.
According to their deeds, so will he repay. Wrath to his adversaries, repayment to his enemies, to the coastlands he will render repayment.
Okay. You've got there, the translation I have, I believe, uses the word island specifically there, but he's not talking about, you know, punishing, the coastland and so forth as far as the land, but it is a reference to the people. Some nations are like mountains, and then you have some other nations. It's kind of like today. Are all nations equal as far as strength and power? You know, I mean, you look at a little place like Venezuela, and you compare it to the United States. There's a huge difference between the two. Well, that's always been true. Throughout human history, you have some nations, some areas which are large, significant, powerful, and then you have some lesser powers. And that's all that John is doing here when he talks about the islands and the mountains fleeing away. It's the fierceness of his wrath. Verse 19, the end of that verse, and then he comes right out and talks about the islands and the mountains. You know, there's just nothing people will be able to do at the end of time. And then he continues with the point in verse 21. There he refers to great hail, every stone about the weight of a talent. He says it comes down out of heaven upon men. Well, again, he's not switching forth, not switching back and forth and saying this is going to happen to the mountains and the islands and, you know, now we're going to deal with the human beings. No, but people of all classes. And he says men blaspheme God because of the plague of the hail, for the plague thereof is or was exceeding great. That's bad stuff. John, anybody, I think I've asked this question a time or two before, but a few of us have been hit by hail. And it's not a pleasant experience. Pea-sized hail can hurt. And when you start getting to baseball-sized hail, what can hurt? What can it do? It can kill you. Well, if you've got the kind of hail that John is talking about here, and people vary the weight a little bit. Some would put it as little as 60 pounds. Others would put it a little over 100 pounds. But I'm guessing that we're probably in the 90 to 100-pound range. Can you imagine being hit with a 100-pound chunk of ice? I mean, even if it wasn't dropped from very high. But, you know, you can imagine, I don't think these hailstones are just kind of being gently, you know, laid down. I mean, it sounds like they're being thrust down. And it is another way of saying, as you look at where this is, the seventh seal, when people stand before God, if they are not in a right relationship with Him, they're going to take a pounding. And it's going to be as bad as, well, I don't think that we can imagine it. Now, if they didn't get it with Jesus, and remember how the Lord described hell? The weeping, the gnashing of teeth, the furnace of fire, where the worm dieth not and the fire is not quenched. I mean, those are some pretty frightening descriptions. But here, as I said, we have information in the book of Revelation that takes us back to a lot of the teachings that are found elsewhere in the New Testament. John just deals with them from a more figurative perspective. And here is an example of that. And it is a frightening example. Sometimes people think, well, you know, God's going to overlook me. He's not going to know about all the things that I did in life, and it's just going to kind of get bypassed. That's not what we find. Elsewhere, we have information about God having a record, and notice there in verse 19 in the middle of the verse. After talking about Babylon the Great, he says, this was remembered. Recall again what we're dealing with as far as time. The Lord has come, we're dealing with the end of time, and God remembers the evil of this people. Now this stuff, some of which was taking place in John's day and time, is old. I mean, it's over 2,000 years old. And if God's promise is right, there's not going to be a single thing that's going to be remembered when it comes to the unrighteous people who lived on the earth at the end of time. Everybody's going to have to answer for their sins, and it's going to be very, very bad. People say, well, God's a God of love. Yes, that's true, but He's also a God of justice. Some have asked why eternal punishment is going to be eternal. I picked up a quote, I think, that deals with that question as far as a summary answer quite well. He says, the answer is that people in the hardness of their hearts will not change. They deserve eternal punishment, and here's the key part, because they are eternally unrepentant. There are many folks, I think, who believe that if people in hell were given another chance, they would truly repent. I'm not sure that that's true. And I'm not sure that that's true because of what we find in verse 21. You've got the hail. And what do people do? They don't cry out, God, we're sorry. God, give us another chance and we're going to believe. But the people say blasphemous words. They blaspheme God. There is no hint of sorrow. There is no remorse there because of the plague of the hail. For the plague thereof is exceeding great. So hell is going to be for the people who deserve that because of the spiritual choices that they made. And it's going to be a very, very bad spot. As you come to, and that's why John uses that word previously in Revelation 16:16. He talks about the battle of Armageddon. I mean, this is going to be it. This is going to be where the rubber meets the road as far as people who have made bad spiritual choices. And, you know, the train's going to come off the track for some folks. But a lot of people don't believe it or will not realize it until they leave this life. Anything that you want to add or ask? Okay. Then let's pick up with what we have in Revelation 17, verses 1 and 2. He says here, "And there came one of the seven angels that had the seven bowls." That, of course, would be the seven plagues, the seven bowls of wrath that we just have finished up with. "And spake with me, saying, Come hither. I will show thee the judgment of the great harlot," or the great whore, the great prostitute, depending on your translation. "The great harlot that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication. And they that dwell in the earth were made drunken with the wine of her fornication." Now this chapter is closely connected to the preceding two, that is, or to the preceding one plus the next one, Revelation 16 and Revelation chapter 19. In this chapter, John, as we just read, is going to use the image of a prostitute to describe one of the forces that Satan uses throughout the Christian era. Now, when you think of a prostitute, you know, a couple things might come to mind, but what do you think John's point is? Why do you think he uses the image of a harlot? For a harlot to be successful, what does she have to possess? All right, that's the key word. She has to be seductive. She has to be enticing. I mean, if you've got somebody that, you know, that's trying to be a harlot at the age of 100, all wrinkled up and crumpled over, I mean, it's probably not going to work too well. You know, she's got to have some attraction. And that's exactly what John is going to say as we continue to go through the chapter. Well, when you think about what we've said thus far, how are you going to seduce people? How are you going to reel them in, lure them in, if you're Satan? What have we been talking about?
Well, giving them the things that tickle their ears that okay. pleases them, like some people just love that band.
Okay, that's right. Now, we've talked about the devil, and we've said that one of his helpers is evil civil government. Remember, Revelation 13, verses 1 through 10, that government that oppresses God's people? All right, is that going to be a good way to seduce folks? Go out there and put you on the rack, torture you, and kill you? Is that going to be a way to win you?
No.
Well, probably not. What's that other beast? Revelation 13, verses 11 through about 18. Evil civil authority and apostate religion. Do you think Satan would be able to use apostate religion to seduce people? Absolutely. And he has it in a lot of different forms. And that's why I say, as you look at this word Babylon, you go back and you look at some of the supplemental information on the sheet. I don't think false religion is exclusively the point, but it is definitely tied in to what we see. So we've got here in Revelation chapter 16, you know, the finishing up the information about the seals. John continues with this, you know, theme of false religion in Revelation chapter 17. He's going to talk about the judgment on this power in Revelation chapter 18. And you can see why, because as he talks about the power of false religion, he uses words like adultery, harlot, fornication, and so forth. And then when we get over to Revelation chapter 19, we're going to have some rejoicing. God's people are told that these powers, these tools of Satan, they're going to be overcome. And God's people in Revelation 19 are saying, hallelujah, thank God that these things are going to be temporary. They're bad. We do have to put up with them in this life, but they're not going to last forever. Now, as I mentioned, the key figure in this chapter, Revelation chapter 17, is going to be the great harlot. The King James translation, if you have that version, it's going to refer to as the great whore. Now, John says that this harlot is located somewhere. What's she doing? All right, she's sitting on many waters. Now, John doesn't often do this in the book of Revelation, but there are some times where he specifically explains a symbol. If we move down a little bit, in fact, quite a bit. Revelation 17, verse 15. Anybody want to read that passage for us? 17, 15. All right, Lois.
"And he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues."
Okay, well, this helps us a bit, doesn't it? John says, 17, 1 and 2, you've got this harlot, she's sitting on the waters. Towards the end of the chapter, he says, these waters where this prostitute is sitting, describe what? They are, all right, basically the people of the world. You know, various tribes, tongues. Tongues, of course, would be another way of describing people, the different languages that they speak and so forth. So very, very clear on that part of the point. Now, when you look at the Old Testament, you have at least three nations that are described in terms of basically harlotry. You know, they're involved with bad things, especially false religion. Jerusalem is described in this way, Isaiah 1:21. Tyre, the nation of Tyre, also in the book of Isaiah, chapter 23, verses 16 and 17. And then you have the nation of Nineveh. Nahum, in Nahum 3, verse 4, uses the image of harlotry, prostitution, whoredom, to describe great wickedness, especially false religion. And you can begin to see what we were talking about earlier. Remember John, he's a writer that likes to use contrasts. Again and again, he talks about the difference between righteousness and darkness, truth and error, God and the devil. Now think about the image that's being used here. How are God's people pictured as far as marriage? Christ is the groom, is he not? His people are pictured as the bride. All right. Satan is a father, if you will, of lies, John 8, verse 44. And what does he have? The counterpart to the bride of Christ is the harlot. It's that spiritual prostitute. God's people are involved with what? As far as their relationship with Christ. Truth, right? Truth. Righteousness. Satan, his people are involved with error, lies, and unrighteousness. So it's a very, when you begin to go back and look at the New Testament, this imagery makes all the sense in the world. And it is, as I said, a stylistic thing with John. I mean, he made, I don't know how many sermons he may have preached as far as the contrast, but it sure seems like there was a bunch. Now, I mentioned a little earlier, Revelation 14, verse 8. John there talked about Babylon, and as you go back and you look at what he says about this symbol, there seems to be three things. And let's just go back and do a quick review. Revelation 14, 8. He says there in a second, angel followed, saying, Babylon fallen is Babylon the great, that hath made all the nations to drink of the wine of her fornication. Now, in this particular passage, John says she's great. She's big. If we were going to use another description, what would we say? Big, great, and probably powerful, influential. So when we think about Babylon from the perspective of Revelation 14:8, this is a significant, this is a very powerful enemy. Now, as you look at Revelation chapter 17, verse 5, and that's moving forward a little bit, still talking about this same symbol, Babylon. He says, upon her forehead, a name written, Mystery Babylon the Great, she is the mother. Okay, so she's big, 14:8. But now John also says this Babylon is the mother. Well, what's a mother do? I call somebody a mother. She's nurturing, she's giving birth, she's producing things. Well, there is this evil in the world that, you know, authors false religion. And it just spreads. It goes in a lot of different formats. And, we have plenty of examples of that. And then a little later, in Revelation 17, towards the end of the chapter, in fact, it's going to be the last verse, 18, he says, And the woman whom thou sawest is the great city, which does what? She reigns over the kingdoms of men. Now, notice a couple of things about that. We said we've got Satan, and who are his other two key helpers? Evil civil authority and false religion. Now, as you look at Revelation 13, 18, do you have a reference there to civil authority? The kings of the earth. All right. What's said prior to the kings of the earth? There is the great city which reigns or rules. Is there a distinction between the kings of the earth and the thing or the power that rules over them? Yes, there is. You know, there's something that rules, and this something that rules, or Babylon, has power or authority over the kings of the earth. And we'll say a little bit more about that. But even now, at this point, are there some cases where a government is essentially ruled by religion? Yes. You look at some Islamic countries, and you've got a partnership there. You've got false religion, and you have civil authority that in many respects is evil. I mean, when people start talking about the Bible in a country, a Muslim country, and they go out and behead you, well, it's the religious folks that are ruling, and it is definitely not a good relationship. So John, you know, these two are basically in bed with one another in a lot of places, and that's not always true. Sometimes you have evil civil authority, and they try something that's non-religious like, communism, atheism, agnosticism. But many times throughout history, we have seen an alliance between these two. As you begin to think through the imagery that we have here, it really is very, very powerful. When we look at religion in the world, oftentimes the world rejoices over what I'm going to refer to as religious diversity. You have your faith, I have my faith, we don't agree, but you know we're all going to go to heaven, you know, in different ways, or you've got your God and I have my God and so forth. That's not what we find in Scripture, especially in the book of Revelation. What we're going to see, and what we have seen really in the first two verses, is that when you try to mix, you know, truth with error, or you try to replace truth with error, it's compared to adultery. Now that's powerful stuff, and I think that may be one of the reasons why a lot of people, you know, Revelation is a tough book, and some people, the eccentrics, fanatics, sometimes just want to run over to places like Revelation chapter 20. But as you look at this book, you see a great deal of emphasis on the need to have the truth, to hold to the truth, and do away with the other stuff. Because when you think about if a guy is going to marry a bride, you know, does he want her fooling around with other stuff? Or men? No. And it's the same thing that's true from a woman's perspective. Well, what about Christ? If he's given his system, how interested is he in these other ideas that have come up from men? It's like adultery. It's like adding someone else into the relationship. And God says, I will not tolerate that. If you want to do that, it falls into this category of Babylon. It's presented in terms of adultery. And as we look at chapter 18 especially, which is going to take a little while to get to, God says, this is going to be really, really bad. Let's think back to one of the things that Jesus said. In fact, we'll just turn back to it and read it. We've heard it many, many times. Matthew 7, 22 and 23, verses that I think a lot of people could quote, but not a lot of people believe. I flip back to Zechariah, which probably is not going to do quite what we need to do. 22. Think about the words, many. And this is looking at it, I mean, you could look at it from a lot of different religious perspectives, but this is from a quote-unquote Christian perspective. Many will say to me, in that day, and that's the day that we've been talking about, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy by thy name, and by thy name cast out demons, and by thy name do many mighty works? And then will I profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, and notice these words, ye that work or do iniquity. Now imagine people who did things, what we might have did things that we would normally associate with Christianity. They did many mighty works. And yet, Jesus apparently doesn't dispute the works. But he says, I never knew you. You're workers of iniquity. How come? Because they had somehow become associated with some form of religion that was somehow different or older from what he had given. And this is the same point that John develops, only from a symbolic perspective, and he talks about it in more detail in the book of Revelation. So it's not surprising. You remember 2 Corinthians 11, verse 14, Paul said that Satan is able to fashion himself into an angel of light. Well, there's some people that allow themselves to be fooled. He looks that way. There are some religious groups that look righteous, but the Lord says that that's simply not going to work. And as you look back here in Revelation 17, verses 1 and 2, let's look at it one more time. There came one of the seven angels that had the seven bowls and spake with him, saying, come hither, I will show thee the judgment of this. Notice this, he says the great harlot. Now, if we're talking about here people who are involved with some kind of false religion, when he says great, what's that tell us? It's a lot. Well, what did Jesus say back there in Matthew 7, verse 22? Many. Well, isn't that the same message? Jesus and John were preaching the same gospel. They were just doing it from a slightly different perspective. Paul did it from a different perspective in Ephesians 4. How many gods are there?
One.
How many baptisms are there? How many faiths are there? One. And then Matthew 15, 13 again. Remember, Jesus said, every plant that my heavenly Father has not planted is going to be, it's going to be rooted up. So it is, as I said, coming back to the same thing from a lot of different perspectives. And he uses the word here, fornication, you know, Revelation 17 and the great harlot to describe doing things in a way that's contrary to the New Testament. Now, when we were going through the plagues, we pointed out the plague 1 and plague 3 have a definite association with false religion. And now, as we look here, Revelation 17, verse 1, Let's look at another one of the key words. There came one of the seven angels that had the seven bowls and spake with me, saying, come hither, and I'm going to show thee the judgment. Does false religion deserve judgment? It does. And God says it's going to, you know, it's going to be rooted up. It deserves that righteous judgment. And those who are involved with it are going to suffer punishment, sadly. Now some, as we said, as they're involved with false religion, you find a connection between it and the government. And that's what John says here. As you look at the information that we find in verse 2, he says, with whom, that is, this Babylon, was involved with the kings of the earth, and they committed fornication. Now, that doesn't mean that they were out there sleeping with, you know, President Obama or, you know, President Clinton or President Bush or President Reagan. You know, we're not talking about sex with a national leader. We're talking about here fornication in the spiritual sense that we have, discussed thus far. And John says that this is a very, very bad thing. Let's see, we already talked about Revelation 17, verse 5. Let's see, what else I want to give? We've got about 5 minutes left. Well, I'm going to pause here for a second. Is there anything that you want to add or ask before I try to make a little bit of a transition? Okay. Got through that one too. That one. One of the angels, John says, that had been involved with the seven plagues, we're not sure exactly which one this was, came over and is described to have spoken to John, and this creature said, come, I want you to see what's going to happen. In this case, as we talk about false religion. When you think about some of the nations that have promoted false religion, we mentioned Islam. Have there been some others? Nations that have gotten in bed with religion. You see a partnership between the two. Trace?
England. That's why the pilgrims came to the United States.
Okay. You've got that. That would be another classic example, not that far back in history. Any others? What about Catholicism? You know, they essentially controlled the state for a long time. The Orthodox Church, Jenny, you probably saw a little bit about that. I know from a little time that I had in Russia and Ukraine, it was the same kind of deal. I mean, the church has had in the past a huge amount of influence as far as politics. Even today when we look at our country, the Catholic Church seems like it has some influence with Washington and some others. The Pope speaks, or you've got a cardinal that speaks, and it may not be quite as to the degree that we see elsewhere, but there's that. You've got Buddhism. When Mark Reynolds was here, he talked about Hinduism, and you see how that has, I mean, it's illegal to speak against the religion, so there have been some cases where the partnership that John describes here has been seen and very, very visible. Trace? Right, God's given a standard. We either hold to it or we don't. And we've got standards in life, and just like manufacturing. You know, if you've got a tolerance, or if it says it's got to be, this thick or this thin, or it's got to be of this gauge metal, it either is or it's not, and God's done the same thing. There is a difference here that I want to show you, and it is a subtle difference, but I think it's an important difference. Somebody want to go back to Revelation 14 and read verse 8 for us again? I know we've looked at that a couple times, but there's still something else there that we can dig out from the passage. 14:8, who'd like to read that for us in just a minute? Harvey? And then I'm going to show you a contrast between that and what we have over here in Revelation 17:2. We're ready, Harvey.
And there followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication.
Okay. Now think about that. Here you have Babylon, this bad, evil system which includes false religion. And the statement there is that Babylon forced, they made these people to be involved with false religion. Do you think that's been true throughout human history? Where people have been compelled to be religious? I mean, they could die. if you want to live, if you want to prosper, if you want to buy, sell, and trade, as we saw earlier in the book, have there been some cases where you either are of this faith, or you're dead, or you're toast? Sure. So John recognizes that point in Revelation 14, verse 8. But now look over here at Revelation 14, 2. Got to pay really close attention to the wording, but there is a difference. The kings of the earth committed fornication, and they that dwell on the earth, that is the people, they were made drunken with the wine of her fornication. You get a sense that there's a difference here? Revelation 14:8, do this or die. But over here it's more, there's the wine. It's voluntary in 17:2. So when you look at false religion, it really takes, and it's true of sin in general as well. But you know, you can have people, if they're out, you know, doing something, for example, you know, peer pressure and some other things will force people to do something. But there are other cases where people use their free will and they say, we want this. Satan thus kind of wins on both fronts. But as you look at these passages, you do find this subtle but this important distinction. But regardless of whether people become involved in this kind of stuff willingly, they seek it out, or you know, they don't have any resistance to it, or whether it's forced, it's still going to be bad. In fact, it's so bad, and we see this in Revelation 18:3 as well, that John, as you look at the end of verse 2, if we stick with Revelation 17, he says they were made drunken. They were put into a state, not literally, of intoxication. And that's what, you know, John's saying, this way of life, the things associated with it, it is so bad, it is like being in a state of intoxication. Well, that's, I think, a good point, because when people are intoxicated, what will they generally do? All right, inhibitions are lost, or at least they're minimized. People will do some things that they may not do. They may feel like they are, you know, truly free. Well, false religion does that same kind of thing to people. You know, well, we can do whatever we want. We think that we are completely free, and a lot of times you find that they try to cast off virtually all restraint. Then you also have this point. How well do people reason when they're intoxicated?
They don't.
Yeah, they don't. That's not the time to get good advice from somebody. If a person is involved with false religion, are they reasoning correctly?
No.
If they were reasoning correctly, what would be true? They wouldn't be in false religion. So it's one more good illustration of just how awful this situation is when people begin to fall into it. So today people say, well, as long as you have religion, as long as you have some kind of faith, whatever you want to do is right. But that's not right. We remember Jesus' words as far as the closing point, John 8, verses 31 and 32. Jesus said, if ye abide, what? In my word, then you are truly my disciples. And then he says in John 8:32, if ye know the truth will make you free. And then you have also John 14, verse 6. Jesus said, I am the way. You know, if we're following Muhammad, or if we're following Stalin, or some other leader, spiritual guru, doesn't matter who it is, the Lord said we're going to be lost. He's going to uproot those plants. And he's the way, he's the truth, he's the life. No one comes to the Father